In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
We are working every single day to make sure that as many vaccines as possible come into Canada as quickly as possible. And yes, the turbulence week over week that we're seeing is of concern, and we're watching it closely and we're staying on it.
We started 2021 with hope. The vaccines were coming. Canada led the world with the most doses ordered per person, 9 to be exact. It all started with a phone call from a senior trade commissioner at Canada's consulate in Boston to Moderna's senior vice president of commercial vaccines. Government officials spent the next several months cold calling vendors across the country to secure syringes, vials, stoppers, and swabs. There's so much that needed to go perfectly for Canada to get its vaccines. Supply had to be plentiful. Distribution had to be equitable. Production had to be constant. But this is a pandemic. Everything is far from perfect. So when will we all actually get a vaccine? I'm Fatma Sayed, sitting in for Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Nick Taylor Vasey is an associate editor at Maclean's and the author of the magazine's March cover story about Canada's rush to get vaccines. Hi, Nick. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So there have been so many questions floating around about where Canada's vaccines are and what really is happening. And you were able to go behind the scenes and really understand some of the process that got us here. So I'm wondering if we can start by you telling us a little bit about the government effort to procure all these vaccinations that we haven't seen yet.
Sure. I think there's a lot of places you can start with that story, in part because so many different government departments are a part of this effort. You have the Public Health Agency that provides a lot of advice and guidance. You have Health Canada, which is approving or not approving vaccines. You have Innovation, Science, and Economic Development, which is funding new technology and seeding new Canadian-made vaccines. And then you have Public Services and Procurement Canada, which is going out and buying vaccines largely from international manufacturers. And so there are a lot of start points, but I think one natural one is late May last year when the COVID-19 Vaccine Task Force came together. And they were approached by ICED, the Innovation, Science, and Economic Development folks, and they were tasked with providing advice. So the government came to these people, and they came from a wide variety of corners in the industry, and they said, "What should we buy, and how much should we buy, and who should we ask, and who should we negotiate with?" And so, over the next couple of months, that task force did dispense a whole lot of advice. And then that produced all of the names that we're so used to hearing about in the news: Pfizer and Moderna and AstraZeneca and Novavax and, you know, a bunch of others as well. So it started with those invitations in May to a group of people who had a pretty big task ahead of them.
I found it really interesting when you described Moderna's first phone call with the Canadian government, and this guy, the senior vice president, is talking to four branches of the government, saying that he's never spoken to that many levels of government in one phone call before. Is that normal, or was that sort of structure, the foundation for what seems to be a chaotic process to get vaccines?
I don't think anything about any government procurement in the last 12 months has been normal. In fact, Patrick Bergstad from Moderna, who you're referencing, first heard from a couple of diplomats. So not even people from Procurement Canada or from a vaccine task force or from some sort of corner of scientists in the federal apparatus. He heard from two trade commissioners who work at the Boston Consulate for Global Affairs Canada. So even Global Affairs Canada was in on this. And they got in touch because they said, you know, we've heard about this vaccine you're producing and we're looking for partnership opportunities, including, of course, procurement. And so that conversation produced another one with the Consul General in Boston, whose name was David Allward. And he's since moved on from that job. But he was a former New Brunswick premier. And so he was part of that. And then he passed them off to all of these government departments. And I thought it was funny, too, when Patrick mentioned that he'd never been on a call like that, because he worked at Merck, which is a global pharmaceutical giant, for most of two decades, had been on a lot of phone calls with a lot of governments. And somehow this was the first time he'd spoken to so many at once. And he also said to me that in all their conversations, the Moderna folks kept their webcams on, you know, in their WebEx call, and the federal people always turned them off, which was really funny. I don't know what the backstory is there. I don't know if they're keeping their cards close to their chest or what, but that was a funny bit of color that he offered.
Yeah, I thought that was such a fun image where you're talking about the cure to the pandemic, and the call is so big, and in my mind, so daunting to be speaking to four levels of government, not knowing sort of how this was going to go down. What surprised you when you were talking to all these government bureaucrats and policymakers and procurers and companies? What was the most surprising thing you learned about Canada's efforts to get a vaccine?
I think one of the most surprising things, and maybe it shouldn't be surprising at this point, but one of the most surprising things was just how blind they were all flying constantly. Like, when you think about it, why was it diplomats at the Boston Consulate, who just happened to be in the same neighborhood as Moderna's headquarters, who reached out to Moderna? Why wasn't it somebody from any of the host of departments who ended up being a part of that conversation later? You can make a case for all of them. I would never have guessed it would have been the trade commissioners. I don't think of vaccines as international trade. Of course they are. And of course that's now at the center of this race for vaccines. But in the beginning, when you're making a connection, it just wouldn't have dawned on me that it would have been those people. And so part of it is that procurement, which is usually so regimented and based on, you know, pre-qualified suppliers and just really strict risk-averse government best practices, just ended up being of the Wild West. And so, again, we've heard about that with the race for PPE and the race for testing supplies. But there was something about hearing that the Minister of Procurement and the Assistant Deputy Minister, Ariane Reza, were cold calling people. You know, I'm like, these are miracle drugs that are going to save the world. And they're getting hooked up with Moderna by the diplomats. Like, I can't get enough of the seeming, not quite randomness, but just like pulling a rabbit out of the hat nature of all of this.
Well, it wasn't just that they were cold calling. It was that they had to convince the people on the other side of the phone that they were, in fact, employed by the government of Canada, and they were trying to talk to them about procurement.
Yeah, Ariana, she mentioned a company X. So this was not a vaccine manufacturer, but she told me about somebody. Maybe there was a manufacturer of syringes or swabs or something, and she just picked up the phone and called them, and they had no idea who she was, and they did not trust that she was calling from the government of Canada. So she had to go through, she told me, several levels of verification, which is just, I'm sure, a little bit humbling for somebody in her position who, you know, she's not a typically known as a powerful individual. She's not a politician who commands that level of influence. But she is somebody who signs deals worth millions of dollars. And here she is having to prove who she is. And that was quite something.
What was your takeaway? I mean, you described it as the Wild West just a bit ago. What was your takeaway about our procurement process? Like, should it be strengthened? You know, clearly there are gaps in it. And I'm wondering what your take was after having all these conversations.
Well, procurement is has a bit of an ugly reputation at the federal level in Canada. Canada has failed to procure fighter jets to replace its fleet of CF-18s. It, for a long time, failed to procure helicopters to replace its aging fleet of Sea Kings. The Canadian military is full of machinery and equipment that's described more often than not as aging, and the government's unable to buy replacements. And Procurement Canada was also the steward of the Phoenix pay debacle that saw, you know, like hundreds of thousands of public servants either underpaid or overpaid or paid on weird schedules. And so that was another issue for that department. It's a group of people who work really hard, but the track record on big procurement projects in Canada, I think, is, it goes without saying almost, if you talk to anybody who's familiar with the landscape, pretty poor record. And so here we have a department that needs to, in short order, not play by the rules that it even knows sort of work on buying PPE that the whole world needs and wants. And then it's got to pivot quickly into testing supplies, applying some of those lessons learned from that March and April scramble for masks and gowns and gloves. And then it's got to quickly move into the most valuable commodity of all, vaccines, and compete against the richest countries in the world, while also contributing to this COVAX initiative that is looking to distribute vaccines equitably among countries in the world, including low-income countries. So they were operating in an environment that was uncertain based on their very risk-averse best practices in normal times, which didn't always produce great results. And then here you have like a whole new set of challenges, which Anita Anand, the procurement minister, described to me as three mountains that they had to climb. And they've climbed the first one, the PPE mountain. They've climbed most of the testing mountain, is the way she says it. They're still kind of getting tests and distributing to the provinces. But the third mountain is the tallest and the one with the toughest climb. And this is now the steepest part of that climb, actually getting vaccines delivered to Canada.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
You know, a lot of people looking on the outset are blaming the federal government for various different reasons. But reading your story, it does seem like an incredibly complicated process that was built on the fly and really changed as things happened. Were you able to identify any missteps or any mistakes that were made that could have got us vaccines sooner? Or is this just part of the pandemic sort of rollout where there is so much going on and we're trying to do things as best we can?
I think Canada came into the pandemic, perhaps not uniquely, but certainly structurally unprepared for vaccines. It's now the subject of some national debate just how much domestic vaccine manufacturing capability we have in this country and how much we had at the beginning of the pandemic. And it's certainly the case that millions of vaccines are produced in Canada every year, including flu vaccines and all kinds of therapeutics. But the question is, could any of those facilities have produced any of the leading vaccine candidates, including the approved candidates from Moderna and Pfizer, in short order? And I think the answer is no. And so that's why the federal government spent well over $100 million on upgrades, and then eventually a whole new plant at the National Research Council's Montreal facility called Royal Mount, because they identified a need, and they said, we need in at least the medium or long term to have the ability to produce vaccines in Canada, because the COVID-19 virus isn't going to disappear. We might need to do seasonal vaccine, you know, every year for Canadians. So it was, but that doesn't, you know, that plant won't be open until the end of the year. It will end up producing Novavax vaccines at some point, assuming that vaccine is approved by Health Canada. But it whether or not that's enough for the Canadian people and whether or not the federal government injected that funding quickly enough into that new plant, and whether or not they negotiated hard enough with any of the other vaccine candidates to have those companies find a way to produce and manufacture vaccine doses in Canada is the kind of question that I think really can't be answered until the dust is settled, because there are just so many variables that are floating around, and I think the hard truth is that there was no way Canada could, or maybe very few ways Canada could have quickly come up with a way to produce any of the leading vaccine candidates at home in time for basically the present, in case there were delays with any of the foreign manufactured vaccine doses. I think anyone's hard pressed to come up with a rational explanation of how the government could have done that faster.
Well, it also struck me that, you know, we do have some pieces of the vaccine manufacturing puzzle, but they are, as you said, outdated, and they're not ready to produce a vaccine such as the one we need to combat COVID-19. But what struck me a lot about your story is that there are local companies who tried to help and were turned away. Was that a mistake? Should we have employed more of our biomedical industry into the vaccine making process?
Yeah, so this is where I'm going to slightly contradict myself, because you're alluding to Providence Therapeutics, which was a company and remains a company that tried to secure about $35 million in federal funding for clinical trials for an mRNA vaccine, which is the same technology used by Pfizer and Moderna. This is a Calgary-based company, and last February they were first talking about pivoting their operations towards a COVID-19 vaccine. They at the time were working on cancer vaccines. And so they made the pretty important decision to stop the work on cancer vaccines and shift to an mRNA COVID-19 vaccine. And then by March, they were talking to Health Canada. And by April, they had actually submitted a formal application for funding. And that was through Innovation, Science, and Economic Development. And then they waited. And only in August, and Brad Sorensen, the president of this company, remembers it was the day before Parliament was prorogued, he heard back, and the answer was no, that funding's not on the table for you guys. And the reason given was that that particular vaccine candidate wasn't far enough along. So Moderna and Pfizer were much further along as examples. And so they didn't receive similar funding, but they were seen as candidates that were likely to be approved by Health Canada, and you know, so Providence got turned away. They eventually got a few million bucks from the National Research Council for some work, and they're now doing clinical trials. But that's definitely an example of a Canadian company that could have been further along developing its own vaccine candidate. Whether or not it would have been successful, how quickly it would have been successful, again, those are hypotheticals that are fun to think about, hard to know for sure. Though if you talk to Brad Sorensen at Providence, he's pretty sure they would have been further along, and that was a domestically produced or will be a domestically produced vaccine if it passes all of its clinical trials and ends up being approved by Health Canada.
Should we be concerned that the Canadian government isn't telling us exactly what's in their contracts with all these big pharmaceuticals? Because that's something that struck me in your behind-the-scenes look at how Canada got here, right? Where you know, the Minister of Procurement has said many times now that Canada's contractually bound to keep the COVID-19 vaccine contract secret. We really don't know what they've agreed to. And so why the secrecy? And is that concerning?
Well, I think the reason for the secrecy is that the federal government, like many governments in Canada, is almost bound by a culture of secrecy. And that's a huge problem across portfolios and across national debates. There's a lot we don't learn about the way the federal government operates and the reasons they do things they do. In this case, I think really the biggest gain they can make, or the biggest benefit of publishing at least parts of the contracts, not all of the contracts, but parts of them, is to help build trust with an increasingly skeptical public. Because if they have nothing to hide in the contracts, and this is going to sound a little bit like a partisan conservative or New Democrat, but if you have nothing to hide, then show what you can and try to build that bridge with people who are starting to wonder, what's in these things? Why are there delays that are hitting Canada harder, it appears, than other countries? I don't think necessarily there are crazy things, clauses and terms and conditions in these contracts that are wildly out of step with the rest of the world or our peer countries. But it, I don't know. I feel like, well, geez, maybe there are, though, if they're not going to disclose any of these things. The Americans have disclosed parts of their contracts. The EU has. Brazil has. It's a contract is not from top to bottom confidential, depending on the particular terms and conditions. Like, you can publish certain things. Other countries have proven that. So they could build trust in a big way, or at least rebuild some of those that fraying trust by publishing some of them.
I'm trying to be optimistic about vaccines, and I'm trying to trust that they will come eventually, and they'll come in a way that we'll all be okay and we'll all get our doses. The government said that Pfizer has a shipment coming next week, and that, you know, we'll have a flood of vaccines coming in late March, early April. But it's all contingent on, you know, there being no more production delays. The European Union, who we seem to be entirely dependent on, doesn't sort of, you know, change its mind or get angry at Canada or anything like that. Based on your research and your conversations, what could a country like Canada do from now till, I don't know, a couple of months from now to both increase the COVID vaccine supply and just improve pandemic preparedness?
Well, I think one of the scariest parts about the vaccine rollout for the kind of typical Canadian, and probably for some people in Canada's federal bureaucracy, is that a lot of this is out of our control. Pfizer and Moderna are private companies, and, you know, whether it's nefarious or not, and I'm not suggesting it's all nefarious, but no matter what the cause for any delay, that's out of our hands and totally in theirs. And you can lobby the European Union, and it sounds like the European Commission has not put Canada in the crosshairs of any export control or export transparency measures. But at the end of the day, it's a European decision. And we have lobbied, apparently, the Biden administration. Doug Ford has very loudly pronounced that he almost begged Joe Biden to redirect some of the U.S.-produced Pfizer doses from that Kalamazoo, Michigan plant to Canada. But that's a Biden administration decision. And we have our contracts. We have the terms and conditions. The Moderna fellow, Patrick Birkstead, told me that there are penalties in that contract if they miss their supply targets, which it sounds like are quarterly. But beyond that, you just kind of cross your fingers and hope that there aren't any more supply delays, and that vaccine nationalism and the protectionism that's started to sort of trickle out of foreign legislatures is going to, you know, you hope cooler heads are going to prevail. We're kind of at the mercy of everyone else. And it's a little bit defeatist, I guess, almost nihilist to live that way. It feels like that's how we're living so much of the pandemic, because we can only do what we can do. We can only stay home. We can't control anyone else's decisions. I don't think there's any reason to believe that the procurement minister, Anita Anand, or Justin Trudeau are lying when they say they're confident 4 million Pfizer doses will get to Canada before the end of March, 2 million Moderna doses will get to Canada before the end of March, and then this significant ramp up will happen in April and then May and June. There's no reason to believe they're lying. They may be wrong, but it sounds more and more like they are indirectly referring to clauses in those contracts saying, if Canada does not receive those doses at that time, then those companies, you know, they got to pay.
I'll cross my fingers if you cross them too, Nick. Thanks so much for being here.
Sure. Thank you.
That was Nick Taylor-Vasey, an associate editor at Maclean's. And that was The Big Story. You can find more at thebigstorypodcast.ca. If you want to chat with us, you can find us on Twitter at thebigstoryfpn, or send us an email, thebigstorypodcast@rci.rogers.com. I'm Fatma Sayed. Thanks for listening.
Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.